I've got to explain this. This talk I'm doing today, which should be quite interesting to do in the US environment, and you'll see if it works or not. But basically, this talk I'm doing today is Steve's talk's obviously been looking at the hidden history of the 18th century, looking at hidden histories. This talk is very much centered around hidden history, but also about how radical narratives have been written about certain very important events in British history, but also about other events that are not so well known. So kind of looking at a kind of distortion or a kind of bending of history into a certain direction, particularly in the labour movement in Britain, or labour histories, trade union histories. And that involves a kind of distortion of history to a certain extent for certain political reasons, I'd argue, but also a tendency to ignore very important events. So that's what the talk's about. Now the difficult bit is I'm going to try and talk about four events in particular, which some of you may or may not know about. Some of them are very iconic in British history, and others are pretty well unknown. So just to start, these two pictures, this picture here is representing a tall brother martyr, and I'll talk about them in a minute, but it's a person in chains. Right? The period I'm talking about is between 1819 and 1834. Okay, so chains. This painting you might recognise, which is called Liberty Leading the People, comes from the French Revolution of 1830. Okay, where the Bourbon dynasty was overthrown. Okay, so this is in the same period, very much in the same period as this. These representations, I would argue, are quite different. We'll come on to that in a minute. So if you want to put up the next slide. So just to show you what I'm going to talk about, I'll do a little introduction. I'm going to talk about these four events, and I'll come on to them in a minute. Peterloo, the Bristol Riot of 1831, the Captain's Swim, and the Tolbert of the Martyrs. I've got a few thoughts and a few conclusions. Okay, so what I usually do, and I did this at trade union events this year, was a straw poll, which is basically you have to participate here, by putting your hand up. Okay? So don't be embarrassed if you know something, and if you don't know about it, keep your hand down. So first of all, I'm going to ask some questions, right? And I won't explain them, but the first one is, does anybody know, has anybody heard about or know anything about Peterloo? If you have, put your hand up. So we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, mostly Brits, 10, 12, a few historians. So we've got 12 people, that's probably about, a third of you, is it? Something like that. About a third of you know what Peterloo is. Does anybody know what or who or what is Captain Swim? You know about Captain Swim, put your hand up. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. About the same, maybe a little bit less.
Mostly told by you.
But mostly because I go on about it.
Because you talked about it last night.
Okay. Oh yeah, sorry. You didn't know before that then?
No.
Alright, lucky you. Right, and okay, the third question is, does anybody know who the Tolpuddle Martyrs are? Tolpuddle? Right, mostly Brits, same people again. Right, so basically I'm on a loser here, aren't
I? we're not Brits.
Sorry, but you're historians, I think. Yeah, okay.
So,
and I'm not even going to say Bristol 1831, because I'm going to guess that the same people probably know about the riots in Bristol in 1831. Certainly the Bristolians. Yeah, okay, you've heard about this before. Okay, these are four events I'm going to look at. Right, I'll try and explain now what... If I took you to the TUC conference, Southwest TUC conference, in March of this year, and I sat in a room with about a similar number of people, maybe a few more, maybe 50 or 60, and I asked the same questions. And the two questions I asked were, does anybody know who the Tolpuddle Martyrs are? And the whole room put its hand up. Everybody in the trade union movement in Britain knows about the Tolpuddle Martyrs. It's an iconic moment in their history. It's a point where a group of rural labourers, and I'll come up doing them, were arrested because they joined a friendly society, an early form of trade union, or an organisation that probably led to trade unions. Okay? They were arrested. They were put under a charge which comes from a Mutiny Act in 1797 for signing notes. So basically they were arrested for trying to combine together to form some kind of organisation that might fight for their rights and wages as workers. Okay, it's iconic. Everybody in the trade union in Britain knows about it. And most people in Britain have heard of Tolpuddle. Tolpuddle is the village where they came from. And the Tolpuddle Martyrs are these rural labourers who were eventually tried and transported to Australia. for their crime of forming a combination, combining together. So everybody knows about it. It's well known in Britain. It's very well known in the workers' movement left in the trade unions. So it's an iconic bit of history. In the same meeting, I asked those 50 or 60 trade unions, who knows about Captain Swing? And I'd say about a third or less of the audience put their hands up. Okay, so maybe a group of people, a few historians put their hands up, a few students who were there, some of our group just started to know. So I'm just trying to get an idea in your head, first of all, with these two events. So an iconic bit of trade union history to do with these people who were sent off to Australia and transported to join a trade union. And this other event, Captain Swing, which I'll come on to in a moment, a huge series of rural riots that occurred 3 years before that. Probably one of the biggest outbreaks of biggest uprising in the 19th century by rural labourers. Okay? There's probably a bit more to it than that as well. So in my head, where this talk comes from is, why is it that I've got people who are, educated trade unionists, they know what they're talking about, they were mostly organisers, but they didn't know anything about this huge event that happened, but they knew about this other event, which was iconic in their own history. And that's where the talk comes from. So I think about, why was it that they knew about four people, five people sent off to Australia, but they didn't know about a massive series of what I would call class struggle that occurred in the same period. They had no idea about it at all. And that's what brought me to this talk. And that also, a few years ago when we did the first Radical History events, I started to look at the riots in Bristol of 1831, another event, okay, and how that was understood and represented by historians. And then I also recently read this book, which is called Live, Working or Die Fighting. I highly recommend it. It's written by an economics correspondent for the BBC, who's on television a lot, but it's a really good book, and he's a good working class activist, or was. But anyway, this book talks about Peterloo, another incident I'll come on to. Right? Now, Peterloo is also iconic in the left. Peterloo, I'll explain in detail about it in a minute, is an event where a large crowd of people who are working class people who've organised to try and to protest and campaign for enfranchisement to get the vote were cut down in Manchester. And it's well known, the Peterloo Massacre. It was actually in St Peter's Fields. I'll come on to why it's called Peterloo in a minute. It's a kind of ironic joke by the working class. So Peterloo, well known, another similar iconic incident to Toll Puddle. At the same time, the Bristol riots of 1831 do not fit into that category at all. They are pretty much ignored or denigrated. So that's where the talk comes from. It's trying to think about why in trade union labour history certain events are emphasised and certain events are ignored or distorted. So the two things I'm looking at, hidden histories, right? I was trying to think of some hidden history of the US when I was putting this together. And so what do I mean by hidden history? Well, I mean, I've got some examples from Britain which are probably useless here, but what I would say is last night we were at the Brett Forum and we were talking about hidden history, and I was saying, well, okay, in the Brett Forum, I think it's very close to Hewson's Tavern, where in the Many-Headed Hydra, a very important book for our group, the authors Peter and Marcus talk about the 1741 rebellion or planned insurrection, which occurred very close to, I think, where the Brett Forum is. Is that right? Hewson's Tavern? Close?
Very.
Okay. Now, I won't go into the details of that, but that's a kind of hidden history, and I encourage the audience last night to go out and maybe do some history events around the 1741 insurrection, which was potentially an attempt to overthrow the British Empire and the Americas. Another example, perhaps, that I've come across recently of hidden US history is to do with Rosa Parks, which obviously is an iconic figure in American civil rights history, but I've kind of learned recently, and you might want to correct me, but Rosa Parks wasn't just somebody who got on a bus one day, right? She was actually an activist, right? And so the first thing you think is, maybe it wasn't what I thought it was, because it's often presented as being this moment where somebody just got on a bus and got fed up with segregation and sat in the wrong place and everything went off. But actually, Rosa Parks is an activist. But then I read a book by Robin Kelly called, what Race Rebels, probably it's called now. Robin Kelly, an academic who does a lot of interesting work around black history. And he'd written a really good chapter where he looked at the bus records for the bus company in Birmingham, Alabama, prior to Rosa Parks' intervention. For 30 years, there'd been a kind of struggle going on the buses every week. There was people refusing to sit in the right places. There were people being chucked off buses because they wouldn't sit in the, you know, the black area. They wanted to sit in the white area. People were shot. People were pistol whipped by bus drivers who were armed. You know, there's a whole history behind what happened to Rosa Parks. And what happened is the activists had picked up on this history and realised, right, we can go and do something around it. So suddenly it opens up another vista. That's a hidden history to me. That there was this struggle for a long time before Rosa Parks. It was self-organised. It was, in fact, not even self-organised. It was just a reaction of working class blacks, particularly to that kind of segregation. So that's these are my examples of hidden history. So that's these are my examples of hidden history. So that's these are my examples of distorted history. Is I would say probably one of the most important books I read was a book about U.S. history. It was called Dynamite, by Lewis Adamick, and it talks about, you know, the violent class struggle of US history from kind of the Mollywood wires right the way through to gangsterism in the late 20s and early 30s. And that book, I would say, is a good example of me realising that US history has been very much distorted from what I've seen. I didn't realise that US history was littered with such violence, you know, and the accumulation of land, also the wage struggles of the late 19th century and the IWW and all this. I learned a lot when I was younger, 25 years ago, and I read that book. So that's, to me, an example of distorted history. We, I think, in Britain have a very distorted history about the US. So these are the two things I'm looking at, hidden histories and distorted histories. I'm not going to talk about sources. You'll have to talk to me afterwards about that. But so if you want to go on, Rich. Okay, Peter Lewis, it's a painting. Kind of what happened in Manchester in 1819. Okay? As you can see, it wasn't very nice. It's a big demonstration being cut down by soldiers and militia and cavalry. Let's put it in context. Basically, what was going on in Manchester? Manchester grew as a city very, very rapidly towards the end of the 18th century and into the early part of the 19th century. I think somebody was saying it was kind of quite a small town and then had 200,000 people. Now, in this city in 1819, this is after the Napoleonic Wars. There's radical agitation going on. The working class are made up of weavers, all sorts of other kind of wage workers and industries that are built up around Manchester and the environs of this city. And they were actually involved actively in a campaign to fight for the vote, to get enfranchisement and other demands as well, obviously, formation of trade unions, all this sort of thing. So in 1819, and what I'm going to say now is kind of the narrative that most people in Britain would know about, most of the left would know about, I would argue. The narrative goes like this. Large numbers of very organised groups of working class people around the city of Manchester planned a demonstration in 1819 where the radical orator, Henry Hunt, who's probably up here somewhere, would come and speak. And Henry Hunt was, you know, sort of veteran radical campaigner for enfranchisement and other demands. And so he was coming to speak in Manchester. All around the city, groups of workers organised themselves to plan a big march to hear Henry Hunt speak and kind of demonstrate that they were very organised and reasonable set of demands that they wanted. Okay? It was a peaceful demonstration. It was planned to be peaceful. No one was allowed to come along with any. You weren't even, normally in those days, to have a walking stick. You weren't even allowed to bring a walking stick. Okay? Only old people could have walking sticks. It was well organised. No weapons, no threat of anything. People marched in battalions, you know, together, wearing laurel leaves and flags, and everybody was decked out, children, lots and lots of women on this demonstration. And this march comes into the centre of Manchester in 1819, and they gather around this in St Peter's Fields, area of Manchester, and they line up and the speeches start. Okay, what happens is that the local kind of business class, I think Steve mentioned earlier on, had formed a militia, had a militia, which is mainly made up of local businessmen, landowners, kind of petty bourgeois, owners of big pubs and things like that. They got them together and they kind of decided that they were going to kind of stop this demonstration and arrest the radicals who were speaking. The militia turned up. They're on horses, they're armed, they've got sabres, whatever. Alongside them, they've got a unit of the British Army cavalry as well. Okay, so in goes the militia, into the crowd, they trot towards the front. There's a lot of jostling and trouble because the crowd's so big, it's something like 60,000 people, which you can imagine 1819 is a very, very big crowd. 60,000, probably a quarter of the population, maybe more. They go to arrest the radical agitator Henry Hunt, and trouble breaks out. They do arrest
Bamworth and some of these other agitators, but there's trouble, and eventually fighting breaks out. Some of the crowd try and stop them doing it, but fairly peacefully, and panic breaks out in the crowd, and at that point the militia start hacking and slaying the crowd. And the British Army unit or cavalry go in to rescue the militia, and in the ensuing chaos, something like 400 people are injured, which about 170 of them are cut with sabres. The crowd scatters, lots of people are trampled. The first victim is a child who's, you know, tossed out of the arms of a woman who's cut down by this militia. And eventually, I think there was, I can't remember exactly how many deaths, it wasn't many deaths, maybe 11. And then the rest of the injuries were pretty severe. People obviously died afterwards and things like that. The crowd's broken up, and it is iconic in British history, the moment where the ruling classes, in a kind of evil way, cut down this crowd for no particular reason. They had reasonable demands, they were peaceful, they were organised. This wasn't a mob from Kingsville. This was like proper working class people, you know, a progressive force that was cruelly cut down at that point. What happens after this is there are trials. The radicals are put on trial for sedition or whatever, and this moment goes down in British history as kind of a turning point, I think. That's the kind of narrative that most people would have in Britain about Peterloo. What I'm going to do now is, before we go any further, I'm just going to read something which is very interesting, I think. This is a section in this book talking about Peterloo. This is a worker from a suburb of Manchester. I think it's a weaver speaking here. And he's talking about what went on before Peterloo happened, before this march was organised, what his life was like as a worker. But one of the things he says in his statement is this. This is going on in the trials, a lot of this stuff happens, the trials of these radicals, right? This is what one worker said. He said, when dusk came and we could no longer see to work, we jumped from our spinning looms and rushed to the sweet cool air of the fields, or the wastelands, or the green lane sides. We mustered, we fell into rank, we faced, marched, halted, faced about. Or in the grey of a fine Sunday morn, we would saunter through the mists, fragrant with the night odour of flowers. A police informer, who was at the trial of these radicals as well, also said this. He gave information about similar events. So what we've got here is workers leaving their looms, going up onto the moors near Manchester and drilling. Okay? Mustering and drilling. And this is what a police informer said. He said he's watching this. These hundreds, if not thousands, of working class people marching around. After they had done exercising, they formed a circle around their commander, who told them that the intended meeting was put off on account of their paper being illegal, but that would give them more time to drill. He then said they must have a colour and they must subscribe. Okay, so there's these figures. Hundreds of workers around them are marching around. Thousands of people were involved in this drilling activity. Okay, usually led by old soldiers of the line. So this is demobbed British soldiers who fought in the Napoleonic Wars, organising these sections of the working class. Right? A consistent detail in police reports was a simulation of firing musket volleys by clapping hands. Okay? A witness statement taken by magistrates on the 10th of August described 3,000 men drilling near Middleton, in the suburb of Manchester. This is what an informant said. The right wing advanced first, and the words of command, fire, front rank kneeling, and when the word of command fire was given, they clapped their hands. The leader then advanced to the left wing in the same order as the right and ordered them to fire. They clapped their hands. This was repeated several times. Okay, so this is very strange. This is happening before Peterloo. We've got like 3,000, you imagine, right? I don't know what district around here, but we could probably multiply that by 50 or something. But imagine if there was like 20,000 people up in Harlem marching around, drilling on the streets or on the parks of Harlem, right, tonight. Imagine that. Imagine there was 20,000 people doing that, right? I mean, there'd be a national emergency. Okay, this is not stuff that's normal. This is not people sitting around in smoky reading clubs, you know, saying, oh, you know, I think we'll have a demonstration next week. This is major, major stuff. Very, very strange thing to read. And suddenly the narrative is changing here. The narrative that's been put forward about this event is not, you know, is for a particular reason. And I would stress that these are the following elements of the normal narrative of Peterloo. Okay, the normal narrative of Peterloo is basically stresses reasonable demands, that the demonstration was organised, that it was non-violent, that, you know, in fact these people were victims of the Hussars, and that, you know, really it's a question of good and evil. The authorities evil, they cut them down, these people good. Okay? But this kind of, this information here is saying something quite different. It's saying that actually these people were planning an insurrection, or potentially planning an insurrection. That's why they were drilling in their thousands. That's why they marched into this square in their thousands in an organised manner. Okay? And that's a sudden switch away from, you know, from the way I would see it from when I was growing up and when I read. Okay, I'm just going to flick on to the next slide. That's all right, Rich. Okay, so I've gone through this. I'm just going on to the next one. Right. A couple of times in this talk, I'm going to talk about how things are remembered. So there's a couple of plaques here, and this is the first plaque that was put up to remember Peterloo. And I'll explain now what Peterloo was. Peterloo is in St. Peter's Fields. This is an ironic name, because the Battle of Waterloo happened in 1815. Okay, so the ironic word for this massacre was to call it Peterloo. It's ironic. It's like saying, well, the British troops cut down the French at Battle of Waterloo, and they came to Manchester and cut down their own working class. Okay, that's why it's called Peterloo. And this plaque here says, and this is on the site, originally on the site of where the massacre occurs, it says, this is the site of St. Peter's Field, where on the 16th of August 1819, Henry Hunt, radical orator, addressed an assembly of about 60,000 people. Their subsequent dispersal by the military is remembered as Peterloo. Okay? Well, you can have a little think about a subsequent dispersal. Okay? This is a plaque that went out after that, because people didn't like this one. You know, some lefties thought, well, that's a bit rubbish, really, isn't it? Because the subsequent dispersal is not 400 people cut down by sabres. Because I've got this one here, right? St. Peter's Field, the Peterloo Massacre, getting somewhere now. On the 16th of August 1890, the people rallied 60,000 pro-democracy reformers. Okay? I would point to this word, pro-democracy reformers, right? Men, women and children was attacked by armed cavalry, resulting in 15 deaths and 600 injuries. 600 injuries, they say. Okay, so there's a bit of a change going here. This was, I'll give you the dates of the plaques. This was earlier than 2007. This happened in 2007. But notice these words, pro-democracy reformers, men, women and children victims. Pro-democracy. Okay. Now, the question is that what plaque should we actually put up? Because I might put a plaque on the end there which might say something like this. St. Peter's Field, the Peterloo Massacre, right? On the 16th of August 1819, a rally of 60,000 potential insurrectionists who had been drilling for several months prior to that, in the event of the need to overthrow the government and institute enfranchisement by force, was attacked by armed cavalry. Resistance carried on the rest of the day after the massacre. There were significant riots after that period. And in the following weeks, sections of the working class met and argued incessantly about the need to start the insurrection now because they'd hit us first. And that's evidence for that. Many of these meetings that happened after Peterloo and after the rioting, because that's not talked about at all here, resistance that actually went on. Many of the meetings that went on after that were talking about, you know, basically people felt they'd done all this drilling for a long time, and now was the time to strike, because they'd struck first. And very, very interestingly, if you look into the history of this, I think it's the mayor, the person who actually launched the attack on this demonstration, clearly says that they were very frightened about all this drilling. It reminds me very much of what was going on in 1994 in Shepherd's, where people knew something was going on, they weren't quite sure what it was. But they certainly got in first and trapped, they smashed them first. It was a ruling class attack on what they regarded as a major threat to their position of power at that point. Yeah, that's a very different narrative to what these other things are saying. Right, move on.
That's right.
Ray, Bristol. Okay. I'm now going to counterpose Peterloo and the narrative of Peterloo, the various narratives of Peterloo. We're looking at the Bristol Riot of 1831. So I'm not going into much detail, but again, you've got a lot of, I think, dragoons in this case, cutting people down. This is a painting showing the centre of Bristol after it's been pretty much razed by the crowd that formed in 1831. Now, why brought Bristol Riot up? Bristol Riot is basically characterised by the following things, right? It happens because the Reform Act to enfranchise people is defeated in 1831, okay? So they put forward an act to try and enfranchise 20% of the population. At the stage, it was only 5%. Mainly the middle class men, traders, class of people, property owners. That act is defeated in Parliament. People, the Speaker of the House, the House of Parliament, the House of Lords comes to Bristol to celebrate the fact that there is no reform. He meets the bishop, he meets the leaders of the corporations around Bristol, they're going to have a big banquet to celebrate no democracy. Right? Unfortunately for them, a crowd, people turn up, some of whom are radicals, some of whom are political reformers, some of whom it is unclear why they are exactly there, but they turn up. And a riot breaks out. The Speaker is chased over the roofs. This square, Queen Square, is kind of the centre of kind of local class power in the city. It's like a George's Square, beautiful, and it is completely razed by the crowd. And there are 3 days of rioting, and I'll come on to the targets of that rioting in a minute. But anyway, this riot is really characterised by the following things. Most people don't know about it. It was very important at the time. It was probably the biggest riot that happened in Britain in that period. And it's generally characterised as a kind of either a completely disorganised, drunken orgy of violence, burning and debauchery, ending up in a massacre to save everybody from this horrible crowd, this mob. Or alternatively, it's sometimes understood by certain sections of the left as a Reform Act riot. I.e. people turned up very angry. This Bristol mob, working class people, turned up very angry because they not put reform and they had a riot and, you know, it failed because it was disorganised. So they're the basics or narratives. The first narrative, disorganisation, chaos, burning and fire, is the usual one. I'm just going to flick onto the next picture, the next bit, and the next bit. Okay, it's a painting done by an artist called Müller, I think. He was a famous watercolour artist who bravely went out that night and kind of sketched what was going on and looking at the crowd and, you know, it's a lot of his very interesting images. He made this beautiful painting of looking over from South Bristol, a mainly working class area, over the rest of the city. This was shown to us in the Bristol Museum when we were doing some research in 1831. We were looking at it and the curator of the museum, the art curator, said, I was in the museum, oh my God, it was chaos. She said, it's like, look at it, I mean, the rich, she said, most of the wealthy people went off the bath, you know, to try and hide because they were so frightened. The whole city was going to burn, you know. It was chaos, there were drunken people around setting fire, the whole city was burning, it was terrible. And we stood there and said, hang on a minute. I said, this looks like Baghdad to me, right, in the invasion of Baghdad, right? And the reason is, I said, well, what's that? What's that fire there then? And she said, oh, that's the bishop's palace burning. She said, they almost burned the cathedral down, which you can see here, but they managed to stop them by barring the gates. I said, oh yeah. So I said, what's that there? And she said, oh, that's Queen Square burning. It was the centre of wealthy power, mansion house, and all that kind of financial institutions. I said, what's that? And she said, that's the big jail, the new jail. It's a huge jail built for prisoners, right? I said, what's that? It's a toll house burning as well. I said, these are precision strikes, right? This is precision strikes going on here, no question in my mind. A crowd traversed the city destroying symbols that they hated, okay? And what they destroyed was prisons. They did 3 or 4 prisons, released all the prisoners. They did the financial institutions, they did the clergy, burned the bishop's palace down, and they also destroyed all of the wealthy area in the centre of Bristol quite systematically looted it, had a big party as well. So this is not chaos. This is definitely not chaos in my mind. Chaos. I said, well, what happened in South Bristol where they all lived? And she said, oh, nothing happened there. Okay. Nothing at all. It's British, you know, you don't accept nothing. Well, it's fine. It's really strange, isn't it? Why didn't they burn down South Bristol as well? She said, oh, well, you know. She said, I suppose it's about your definition of chaos. So, this is interesting to me. Now, this does not feature, this right does not feature in any real sense until very recently as a part of radical history. And I think I could go on to talk about things like agendas, mobs, crowds, very much can, on the basis of what Peter wrote about the Gordon riots, but we'll just leave it there and go on to the next thing. Right, Toll Brother Martins. This is a museum for the Toll Brother Martins. So the trade union movement threw up a museum to celebrate these heroes of the trade union movement. And I was fortunate enough, to do part of this talk in front of the museum, at a trade union festival which happens every year in Toll Brother. And I was a little embarrassed actually because I was going to be a bit critical of it. So I stood right in front of here doing this talk. So if you put the next slide. Okay, what was the Toll Brother Martins about? I've kind of explained briefly what it was around, but as you've seen already, it's kind of, I suppose I could read this bit of narrative, and this is basically the narrative of Toll Puddle, okay, that most people in the trade union movement will know. Some impoverished workers, and I'll stress some words here, some impoverished workers joined the perfectly respectable Methodist-led organisation, which was dedicated to modern forms of industrial struggle, including the non-violent improvement of wages and conditions. As a result, the local landowners in Toll Puddle, in collaboration with an anti-union government, used the law based on mutiny and implying treason to prosecute a group of innocent men, to transport them to Australia and in so doing martyr them. Okay? A massive peaceful demonstration by the urban working class eventually led to their pardon. A series of demonstrations, 100,000 people in London, where those people marched to support them, stop them being tried and sent to Australia. They failed, they were off, essentially. And eventually, these people were pardoned and they returned to England to live happily ever after. Okay. That's the story that most people know. Okay? And to give you an idea about, if you click on to the next slide. This is a kind of a slide that shows the Toll Brother Martins here, and I think this is the king turning his arse on them and saying, I'm not interested in you pleading. But notice, you know, chain. That's the image. Okay, so that's Toll Brother. Most people know about that trade union movement. It's very well known. We've got history done about it. It's a festival every year. Thousands of trade unions go down there to celebrate the Toll Brother Martins. Next slide, if that's right, Rich. Okay, Captain Swing. Well, I didn't know a lot about Captain Swing until quite recently, but it's a really great book by Fox Ford and George Rudak, if you want to read about it, called Captain Swing, and it's definitely worth having a look at. But a very important moment in history where British Marxist historians started to look into some of this kind of hidden history of rural revolt. And Captain Swing riots of 1830-31 are part of this. Now, this picture kind of demonstrates what was going on in the swing riots, so I'm quite quickly going through it. Over here is a rioting mob, yeah? And they've got banners that say, swing forever. No machines, I think it said. And they're kind of wrecking threshing machines here. Right? They're burning a building. Down here, there's a peasant, in fact, not a peasant, a rural labourer, a rural proletarian, in fact. Carrying a noose and holding it up. And there's people here in the crowd, frightened. There's this haystack, very central haystacks. And on top here, some landowners. And this one's saying, well, I don't think Mr. Swing can come here. And he's going, fire, 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 and pulling off the haystack. Okay, and over all the bastard. Over here, there's some people involved in politics. See it? And this guy's saying, I recommend to this meeting the formation of a yeomanry regiment, which I am willing to take command of. And then if the base peasantry won't starve quietly, we can cut them down like chaff.
And then this person saying, I think that would only make things worse. What we want is reform in Parliament with lower rents, taxes and tithes. You that think of me, hold up your hands. And everyone's going, oh, oh. So this is kind of the sweep of what's going on in the Captain Swing riots of 1831. And what they were was a huge wave of rural revolt, basically brought on, it's arguably, by the introduction of threshing machines, which meant that large numbers of rural labourers, well, especially in the winter, couldn't get enough wages or work to survive. Plus, it also forced the wages down, bringing machines in. Plus, there have been two terrible winters, I think in 1828 and 29, which meant there was less work and obviously less food around. And the result was, in 1830, the summer of 1830, a movement began in Kent, in Essex. In Kent, which is kind of southeast of London, and swept across the country in 3 or 4 months. It's a huge movement of people. Let's give you some ideas about that if you go to the next slide. And the next one. Okay, this is some recent work that's been done on Captain Swing riots. Every time they look at these events, Eric Osborne and George Roulet looked at this in the late 60s, and they came up with that there was kind of 1,500 incidents of things like machine breaking, various types of riot, extortion, robbery in this case is basically extortion, incendiarism, assaults on poor law officials. They reckon there's about 1,500 incidents. Since then, more work has been done, and we're now up to something like 3,500 incidents occurring across the whole of Britain. Okay, and you can see, if you can read this, it's the kind of thing that's going on. You've got to bear in mind things like robbery 252. That's a loaded term, robbery. Extortion by crowd, collective bargaining by riots is what's going on. So basically, all around the country, groups of rural labourers in this wave of disturbances began to confront their landowners, confront the local clergy who were taking their tithes, and either demand the destruction of machines, demand money, or basically show who was in control in those regions. And that was what's going on across the country. There's all sorts of stuff going on. This is very interesting. Rescue of protesters from custody, 102. So that's clearly people going, you know, getting people back from the local authorities. If you go to the next slide, you can kind of see the scale of this. So this is kind of swing incidents plotted out on Britain. Starts in Essex, in Kent, sweeps across southern England in a few, about a month to get from one side of here to there. Get across Sussex, it took 2 weeks. It's hitting right down Dorset, that's Bristol, all the way up to East Anglia. It's a huge movement. You can see this kind of wave of incidents occurring in these months of October, November, December of 1830 into 1831. Now, this is massive. This is a huge movement. We don't even know the half of it yet because we haven't got enough all the evidence in there. It's still being thought, you know, this is recent, 2 years ago, this work was done by people all over the country, went to their local parish registers, read newspapers, and used the internet to build it up. So, if you go to the next slide, you can get an idea about it. So, I wrote an essay called The Flea and the Elephant, Tolpole and the Swing. Okay, because to me, Tolpole's a completely, although it's iconic part of history, it's kind of a flea compared to this incident, Swing. Now, Tolpole happened in 1834, Swing happened in 1830-31, so they're quite close together as two events. But, you know, it amazed me at the time that, you know, that I could go into a meeting with a bunch of trade unionists, and this, a lot of them were rural organisers for, you know, in these counties, and that they didn't know anything about Captain Swing, yet they knew about this one incident. So I have to ask yourself, why is that? Why do trade unionists or members of the labour movement or even lefties know about Tolpole, but they know nothing about Swing, they know nothing about this huge wave of class struggle? And I kind of came to a conclusion, or some thoughts about this, and about which I call ticking the boxes, which applies to all of the things I've talked about. To start with the first box, innocence and guilt. Okay, it's one of the things I talk about when I look at these historical events, innocence and guilt. Okay, the top of the miles are innocent. This lot, these swing rioters and their thousands, if not tens of thousands, are definitely guilty. Okay, they're really difficult to deal with historically if you're trying to create propaganda for the labour movement. Okay, it doesn't work. You can't have people actually burn things down and run around in mobs extorting your stuff off the welfare breaking machines. It doesn't work. Okay, they're guilty. Okay, and to give you an idea about why I hate the word martyrs when it's applied to toll poll, these martyrs have transported me off to Australia. Well, to give you an idea about what happened in Swin, right, the human cost is unbelievable. Okay, there were 2,000 trials during the Swin riots, 2,000 trials. 252 people were sentenced to death, okay, of which 19 were eventually executed. 644 were imprisoned. 500 people were transported to Australia for terms of 7 to 14 years, with little hope of ever returning. This was the largest group of prisoners ever transported from England for a common crime. Now that's got to be on the historical map, isn't it? The largest group of people ever to be transported for one crime, or a group of crimes that were associated with one incident. Right, and the Hobsbawm and Roode, they kind of get this when they're writing their book about Captain Swin. They say, in the south of England, there were whole communities that for a generation were stricken by the blow. From no other protest movement of its kind, neither the Luddites, nor the Chartists, nor trade unions, was such a bitter price exacted. So these Swin writers, they're the martyrs. They're clearly the martyrs. Calling the toll poll by six people, whatever they were. Right. Secondly, it's only very recently that these incidents, the Swin has started to be recognised. If you go on to the next slide. Okay, this is two pictures I think are really funny, well, certainly this one over here. Okay, this is a plaque that was put up in February this year in Salisbury, where a lot of the trials for Swin rioters were done. Okay, and it's supported by the trade unions, and we went down. It's probably the first plaque, major plaque, has been put up to remember these hundreds of people who were tried, some of them executed or transported for these rural rebellions. Okay, so we went down there, and you know, it's in the Guildhall now. It actually says, in commemoration of the local men and women who appeared before this court as a result of the agricultural riots of 1830. This picture is even more interesting. This happened a little bit after. This is from somewhere in Middlesex, I think. And, Hampshire, which is a county south of London. And what I like about this picture is they're celebrating a Swin rioter who was executed, a guy called Henry Cook. And what he did was, we're not quite sure if he did it, but a landowner came down to deal with the rioting mob of Swin rioters that turned up. And a hammer was, or somebody tried to strike, Lord Baring. Okay. Baring, does that ring the bells, anyone?
Yes.
Baring's Bank, yeah, one of the big merchant banks that probably did that business recently. Or not? No, I'm not crying about it. So Lord Baring comes down to these Swin rioters. Henry Cook apparently takes his wife at him with a hammer. He kind of falls off his horse and knocks his hat off. And Henry Cook's executed for it. Didn't actually really hit him or anything. And he gets executed. And this group of people, parishioners in this church, put this plaque up to celebrate Henry Cook, okay? To say it was wrong that he was hung. This is kind of a big change, but a bit of understanding now about Swin. You know, but I laugh because of these parishioners sitting here like supporting a riot. Okay, I'll try and draw this together now and shut up. Okay, if you go on to the next slide. Right, these are my thoughts about all of this, these four incidents and what's going on here. Why, for example, Peterloo is remembered, Toll Pub is remembered, Swin is kind of not, is a hidden history, and the Bristol 1831 riot is a distorted history, in my opinion. First of all, is what I talked about previously, is about the violence, use of violence and non-violence. Peterloo, non-violent, Toll Pub, non-violent, Swin, violent, 1831, violent. Oh dear, tick the boxes for Peterloo and Toll Pub. Your propaganda purposes at the time, you can't tick the boxes for 1831 Captain Swin. Right, secondly, formal organisation and spontaneous revolt. Very much stressed by the left about Peterloo is this organisation. What they don't stress is that organisation was a military organisation that was up for insurrection. Okay, but they stress the organisation, a proper movement, a political party in the making. Spontaneous events like 1831, the riots or Captain Swin just do not tick the right boxes, so they're ignored. Okay? Formal organisation applies to Toll Poll because they were joining a trade union, a Methodist organisation. When it comes to victims or insurgents, I mean, this relates to these times, you know. I mean, a lot of work's been done on Captain Swin over the last few years, and
you know, there's more and more evidence coming out that the rioters, in particularly in the counties of Sussex and Kent, marched around with tricolours, caps of liberty. Caps of liberty? Mm-hmm. Most people in England don't know what that is, but, you know, they marched around. For example, in Kent, you just had this revolution of 1830, you know, the liberty of the people had just happened before that. The country was in kind of uproar about these revolutions in Europe. I think there was a revolution where Belgium had succeeded from the Netherlands that year as well. So what's going on in Britain at the time is there's a big sort of either fear or happiness about the fact that there's a revolution movement breaking out in France. For example, in Kent villages, rural labourers collect money for the victims of the revolution. I mean, what I mean is for the revolutionaries who were killed in Paris. Now, have a think about that. Okay, 1830, there's like rural labourers collecting money in villages in Kent and giving it to French revolutionaries. Okay, so when these riots happen, you do see an awful lot of influence of radical agitation. And I won't go into detail of it, but all I can say to you is that there's a lot more to swing than meets the eye. Okay, it's often been characterised as a bunch of starving rural labourers and that's it. But it was a lot more to it than meets the eye. It probably brought down the government. On November the 9th, 1830, Wellington's reactionary government collapsed and the Whigs took power. It's probably had a part to play in getting us democracy and reform, the first stages of democracy the year after the Reform Act. So again, you know, these images of Peterloo, maybe they were insurgents. In swing, there was major politicisation, I would argue, and there was certainly attempts to politicise it far beyond the demands of the rural labourers. And as we know, revolutions are not clean and tidy things. They're not organised by groups of people in reading rooms who suddenly decide to form a proletarian army and take over. You know, revolutions are uncomfortable, changing moments. And you know, as we know from the French Revolution, you know, the French Revolutions have failed. They may have been dismissed as a bunch of rioters, like in 1831. They succeeded. So there's a lot more to these events than meets the eye. But those things are a little bit embarrassing for social democratic history, so they kind of obscure. The last thing I want to talk about is this thing called the two-sided coin of modernity. That's a bit of a phrase, but what I mean by that is that I would argue that there's kind of two ways or two strands of thought about particularly 19th century history which are worth looking at. The first one is worth understanding. The first one is kind of proto-capitalist, pro-capitalist sort of Whiggist history in Britain, which kind of is what we call modernism, which says that, you know, the history proceeds through a whole series of, you know, changes, but they're all kind of progressive, and eventually you get to, you know, modern representative democracy and capitalism, and that's great. And that's one side of it. And those histories particularly stress that, you know, things like the peasant are backward, rural revolts are backward, the introduction of machinery is progressive, and the reaction to it, like machine breaking, is backward. And they kind of definitely stress that. In fact, they pretty much ignore rural revolts altogether. But where they do have to deal with them, they basically say their reaction is the Luddite, the word Luddite gets turned on its head. The other side of this coin is classical Marxist history, which I'd argue also suffers from similar problems, because classical Marxist history, and I use the word classical in a sense that I won't go into the details, but what I mean by that is the straightforward Marxist histories perhaps of the early 20th century. And then what they say is that, you know, okay, we've got to go through this process from feudalism, socialism, eventually we get to communism, feudalism, capitalism, then socialism and communism. So, you know, go through this thing, and basically, if anything you'll do, if you're a peasant, you can't really overthrow feudalism, you can't really do much else than that. You've got to be proletarianised before you can overthrow capitalism. You know, so there's all kind of like hurdles you've got to jump over, you know. So if you're a peasant, you can jump over the feudal hurdle, we can't jump over the capitalist hurdle. Well, you're proletarianising, you can jump over the capitalist hurdle. And that kind of is also a modernist history. And the problem with it is that it has difficulty then dealing with class struggle, which doesn't quite fit the model. So sometimes it ignores it, and sometimes it kind of denigrates it. But to give credit to the British Marxist or the classical historians, you know, or classical Marxist historians like, you know, kind of early Thompson, Osborne, Rudeau, a lot of the people who've been with it, they did actually uncover a lot of this rural revolt, and they did uncover it through their research because they were looking at history from below, social history. The problem is, this two-sided coin means that a lot of history is dominated by these two ideas, like this establishment history of, like, you know,
pro-capitalist history or a classical Marxist history, which doesn't, you know, can't quite deal with a lot of this stuff. That's why I would argue that from both sides of the academy, whether it's the classical Marxist history or the sort of Whiggish history, things like Captain Swing have been ignored, and certain events like machine breaking as part of that are also ignored. So, for example, people often talk about rural labourers as peasants. Well, they weren't actually; they were proletarians, in fact. So there's a lot of misunderstandings about talking about swing rioters. There's also the problem of the lumpen as well, which I think Peter talks about quite a lot with the picaresque proletariat. The idea of lumpen being, it's like a section of the class that's not really integrated properly into work, this is the discipline of capitalist labour. So therefore, what it does is kind of, at best, irrelevant, at worst, reactionary. Okay, so it's a sort of classical Marxist sort of problem. So a lot of things like 1831 riots are kind of seen as a bit lumpen, can't really deal with that, so we'll ignore that. And also, a lot of the tactics, that's a word that I think Eric Hobsbawm uses quite a lot of the tactics in these struggles, particularly in Swing, also in 1831, but also the Luddites, I think, they call pre-industrial. And what pre-industrial means is that you do things like machines, you do collective bargaining by riot, you do that kind of tactics where communities like Steve been talking about earlier on, that would be called pre-industrial in Kingswood, that kind of rioting or moral economy, that kind of thing. Anyway, and to a certain respect, history really for a lot of the trade union movement, labour movement, the left, begins with the Chartists in 1830 and 1840. Anything else before that's kind of irrelevant, not really important. In fact, somebody said to me in a meeting about Captain Swing, said, well, it's a bunch of starving labourers, why are you interested in that? Well, as far as I understand, I'm sure Karl Marx, who's sitting here now, probably say, well, class struggle is quite important. You shouldn't ignore things because they don't fit the model. And you certainly should ignore things because, history is history. You can't just sweep away whole bits of history and say, I'm not making any comment about whether those tactics were the right thing to do, but they're certainly something we should be aware of. And finally, there's a problem with politicisation, which is that, These events like Swing 1831 in Bristol are perceived as being apolitical, okay? And that certainly fits in with the idea that it's chaos, they burn the city down. They didn't really know what to do it. In fact, somebody argued, a local historian, an academic historian in Bristol, who's actually somebody we've got to speak before, said that, Bristol wasn't really a radical place in the 1830s. It didn't have any reading clubs or radical clubs. There were no radical clubs where people sitting around knocking out leaflets. And that's why Bristol wasn't radical. Well, class struggle goes a little bit further than a few smoky reading rooms, as far as I'm aware. So this problem of politicisation is very interesting, because it's how things are perceived. And if you look at an event and think, that's apolitical, then you won't find the things you're looking for. And in fact, with Swing, we're starting to find more and more stuff about that it was actually very politicised, perhaps Republican. Similarly with Peterloo, you look a bit deeper than the kind of narrative of labour history, and you find that there's insurrection in there, there's republicanism, there's all sorts of ideas floating around the organised working class, there's stockpiling weapons. This is not something that fits in with that narrative. So finally, I'm going to conclude, because I've gone on too long probably, I'm not happy. Alright, so you want to show the next slide, Rich? Okay, so I've sort of exposed some hidden histories about some of these events. Try to count pose them so you can sort of see the differences between them. You have to take my word for it. If you've never heard about these events before, they're understood quite differently in Britain. And I've also talked about these distorted histories. I've also brought up this question of class struggle in many forms. As I said, there's a tendency within the left to believe that it starts with the formation of trade unions. In fact, somebody said to me, the working class didn't... There was no working class until you had trade unions, which is kind of a very strange idea, but I think it certainly dominates some of that thinking. Until you've got trade unions, they're not really interested. They're not even a working class, really, because they haven't actually become a class for itself. Okay. Also, we're talking about agency as well. Agency means the fact that people can actually make some decisions without actually being told by outside what to do, or by outside forces. And agency figures a lot in these events, I won't talk about too much now. But finally, hopefully I've demonstrated that, in fact, a lot of these people weren't actually victims, which is the way they're portrayed. Certainly, in Peter Hill and Tolpuddle. In fact, there's a good story about Tolpuddle, just to finish, right? When one of the Tolpuddle martyrs, one of these trade unionists, early trade unionists, was sent to Australia, okay, he arrived and he was put on a kind of plantation somewhere, I think probably in Tasmania, Van Diemen's Land, I think. And when he arrived there, Osborne and Rude got some really interesting information, because this Tolpuddle martyr arrived and they went, "Oh, you're one of the Dorset machine breakers." That's what they said. "We've got loads of them here." So I'm sure he ran into some of his mates there, people he knew, maybe from other villages or other towns. So what I'm trying to get there is the idea that, you know, perhaps these Tolpuddle martyrs weren't so much martyrs after all. In fact, 3 years before, they may have been in one of those swing mobs who was going around extorting the wealthy, breaking machines and burning haystacks and buildings down to try and increase their wages. So we have to be a little bit careful about bracketing these people as victims. They may have ended up as victims in 1834, but the real victims were from the swing riots. And Peterloo, we might not be talking about innocent civilians cut down, we might be talking about guilty insurgents cut down by a ruling class who reacted before they left it too late. And that's it.
Thanks, that was really great. So was there any stories about what happened in Australia, what all these in terms of insurrection on the plantations, or what happened when all these rebels transported?
Well, I would definitely suggest reading Captain Swing book, because what's great about Hobsbawm and Roulet's history of Captain Swing is they don't stop with the point where these people are transported. They actually carried on doing research about all these people who were sent into, you know, into Australia. And they come up with various different conclusions. I mean, one of the conclusions was said that interestingly, that these swing rioters, these evil incendiaries, these like demons of the countryside who beat and threatened people to get money, in fact they were the most they weren't unruly prisoners. In fact they were seen as very honourable men. So, you know, that kind of turns things on its head a bit, because that would suggest to me that perhaps these people weren't the criminals in the way they're perceived as criminals. They weren't actually the criminals, they're actually a bit more sussed out, a bit more, politicised than perhaps we imagined. They had, you know, a whole series of values based on, you know, kind of that idea that the rulers said, well, actually, they weren't, you know, kind of, they didn't end up in all sorts of criminal activities. I'm not, you know, I would definitely read that section to find out a bit more about what happened in Australia. But they certainly chart them, you know, chart all these groups of people, these hundreds and hundreds of people who were sent there. You know, they look on, you know, they see what happens to them, whether some of them came back. The interesting thing is the Tolpuddle martyrs actually came back from Australia after this big campaign. But they didn't stay in England. I don't think they could really go back to their villages. They came back in about 1837 or something. I'm not going to correct me on that. But when they came back, they ended up in Canada, which is where a large number of rural labourers were sent after the swing riots. As a kind of a jump to the transportation and all that, you know, misery, one of the most interesting things that happened after swing was that two or three changes were made. What the authorities realised was that they had large numbers of rural labourers running around who were like, you know, who were effectively becoming overmanned, so they became surplus to requirements of local, you know, sort of industrialisation of agriculture. So, you know, rural labourers' wages going down, and they were trouble, and obviously trouble in 1831. So the authorities came up with several plans. One of them was assisted repatriation. So the authorities thought, how do we deal with all these bloody unemployed labourers, you know, causing all this trouble? So what they did was they offered the money to go to Canada. So a large number of these labourers were actually shipped out of the counties around London and sent to Canada. In fact, that's where the Tolpuddle martyrs ended up. They ended up in Canada. So it was kind of early ground. The other thing they did, which is something most people in Britain don't know, do you have allotments here? Allotments? Somebody describe what they are? What's that?
Urban gardens,
yeah. You kind of get a little bit, you can apply to get a little bit of land so you can grow vegetables and things like that, and they have plots and allotments around Britain. That comes partly from the swing riots. Because the problem they have is it's sort of starving labourers who are dispossessed of the land, they're proletarians. You know, if the wages go down, they've got nothing, they're finished, you know. So He suddenly thought, oh my God, you know what we've got to do? We've got to give them some land back. You know, take all the land away from them. They decided to give it back, a little bit back, so they didn't starve. So allotments in Britain, this thing that people really regard as kind of their right to have a little bit of land being applied to the council to get it from rented a little bit, actually come from the swing riots. So there were a lot of consequences from the swing riots, which I haven't gone into in detail. I mean, certainly threshing machines were kind of, Hodgepole and Roulet argue that threshing machines were actually banned or not allowed to be used, effectively, because of the swing riots for about 20 years. Mm-hmm. So they actually halted capitalist sort of industrialisation of agriculture in that particular sort of, that particular facet of agriculture. So they were kind of successful. You know, they actually stopped, I mean, you know, the Luddites perhaps weren't, but the swing rioters actually had an impact. They certainly held their own for about 10 or 20 years. They protected themselves by stopping the use of threshing machines. And that's not happened many times in history, I would argue, where, you know, kind of industrialisation has been stopped. So, anyway.
Maybe a more focused question, but it's still big. It's in relation to Hobsbawm and Thompson, both historians, quite well known, and you've mentioned, both of you have mentioned at least Thompson and you more Hobsbawm a lot. And I'm just curious, because you talked about this kind of bias in terms of the lenses of looking at certain things and not at other things. And I just wanted your own sort of expertise through your own work, what you found to be most kind of problematic in terms of their contributions, because you've also said very good things about them. But it's hard to tell other than this kind of bias against a progressivist idea of history, what exactly for you is more problematic.
Okay, well, my
you can focus on it, either one of them.
Okay, well, if I go back to Captain Swing, it's a very interesting book to read, because I know it's a great bit of history, historical research. One of the things you get across when you're reading it is that Hobsbawm and Roulet go in from a classical Marxist position. Okay, they go into this analysis, and they get all this information, and they kind of want to look for certain things, they want to look for other things, but what happens is you feel they're totally, they're kind of fettered in this book. Okay, so they do things like go, how could this have happened? So they think, oh, we better go and look and see if there were organisations already existing in communities, you know, that kind of could have led to. They look for friendly societies, Methodist groups. They're looking for this kind of formal organisations that must lie behind it. You know, must have some impact on what it is. They kind of don't find much, you know, they're a bit like, well, you know. Because what they're looking for is some kind of structure in there, you know, some kind of structure they understand, something that fits in with kind of like perhaps ideas about how working class organisations develop. And they can't really find that. Then they get excited because they come across these really strange events. They come across things like marches, as I mentioned before, where there's clear politicisation. You know, there's kind of Republican ideas. You know, people remember, you remember the swing riots. It's not that long since the Napoleonic Wars, you know. 15 years of war against France, you know, and these slavers marching around, you know, with French flags and tricolours, you know. And so they kind of say things like, well, they were probably just trying to annoy the authorities, right? And, you know, you look at that and you think, well, I don't know. And then they kind of do some stuff on cobblers, like shoemakers. They find that, you know, do some studies on shoemakers, and they find that in all the villages, or, you know, if they were rioting swing villages, they would probably likely to have three or four times the number of shoemakers in the village. They were, you know, famously radical shoemakers, you know, Republican ideas of enfranchisement. So they're kind of looking at all this stuff. But what's problematic is, you know, they can't let themselves go down there too far. You know, they kind of find this stuff and then kind of dismiss it. And then they look for some organisation, it's not there, so they kind of drop that. They're clearly having a problem in understanding how such a wave of you know, activity could actually happen. And they don't really, I would argue, come to many conclusions, other than the fact they put all this exciting information up there that they found, and they get to the end and go, at the end of the day, it was just, you know, it was limited. It was completely limited. It was like, you know, it was based around wages. It, you know, it was related to very limited demands. It wasn't possible for these rural labourers really to go any further than they did. And although there was elements of politicisation, it doesn't really work. And that that kind of is really the fettering and pastor Marxism. It's saying, well, you know, they're not in the right position. Now, you know, to put it bluntly, it boils down to this, right? Okay, they weren't peasants. They recognised that. They were rural proletarians. But you know, a lot of classical Marxist theory believes that, you know, it's about positioning of groups in society in terms of their potential for revolutionary movement. And what classical Marxism says, well, you know, the countryside is backward. The cities are a breath of fresh air. So it's going to happen in the cities, it can't happen in the countryside. Secondly, they say things like, it's got to be the industrial proletariat that does it. Because they're at the centre of power in the capitalist, or the most influential point in the capitalist, you know, capitalist industries. And, you know, it's got to be industrial proletarians that do it. It can't be these other people. So they have to put that kind of fetter on what they're doing. Another kind of would say, well, you know, it's got to be sections of the working class that are in the factories because they're the only way they can produce these organisations that we recognise as being revolutionary, like political parties, you know, formations like that. So all these fetters are on it all the time. And I think that's the problem I've got if I was going to be really specific about what's going on. They've gone in with these preconceptions and therefore the history doesn't quite fit in and they have to dismiss things and drop things. And I'm not arguing the swing movement was necessarily revolutionary, but I would say it would be wrong to suggest that it was purely a wage dispute. Hopefully that answers it. Zaya, do you want to continue? Yeah.